McCarthy, the American-ism. That's our focus on this Echoes of a Century special. I'm King David McKenzie.
There's only one Communist Party. The Communist Party that puts out this pamphlet setting the line for the Communists in the United States is the same Communist Party. They're the one that tells Fifth Amendment Communists how they should testify. It's the same Communist Party, if you please, that ordered American boys have their hands wired behind their backs and their brains blown out with communist machine guns. It's one and the same party, my good friend. Now, there are those who say, well, it's all right to dig them out, but, oh, we don't like your method. You know, it's so easy to make those general statements. And when they say you don't treat them like gentlemen, while we do, I might say that if we did not, I would not cry for them. Traitors are not gentlemen, my good friends. They don't understand being treated like gentlemen. May I say to you, my good friends, tonight, to the American people, that I don't care. I don't give a tinker's dang. How high or how low, people in either the Republican or Democrat party, either party, are unhappy about our methods. This fight is going to go on as long as I am in the United States Senate.
That was the voice of a very bad man. At least, that was the estimation of Washington columnist Drew Pearson early on. It took most of the rest of America about 7 more years to come to the same conclusion. The short description of Joseph Raymond McCarthy's political origins is that he became an attorney at age 27, was elected a 10th Circuit Court judge in his native state of Wisconsin 3 years later, enlisted in the United States Marine Corps early in the American involvement in the Second World War, came back from the war in 1945, was re-elected to his circuit court position that year, and successfully ran as a Republican for the United States Senate from Wisconsin in 1946. For his first 3 years in the Senate, McCarthy actually was more popular as a speaker to social organizations than he was notable as a legislator, until an issue arose in which McCarthy lobbied for the commutation of death sentences for SS war criminals who had perpetrated the Malmedy massacre of American POWs in December 1944. McCarthy maintained that the confessions of the Nazi soldiers were the result of torture and that the U.S. Army was engaging in a cover-up of judicial misconduct, although McCarthy never presented evidence to support that claim. Shortly afterwards, a poll of the Senate Press Corps overwhelmingly chose McCarthy as the worst U.S. senator of the time. The time was the post-war Red Scare period. With the entertainment industry, particularly broadcasting and motion pictures, terrorized by the House Un-American Activities Committee and its chairman, Representative J. Parnell Thomas. Dozens of Hollywood figures were blacklisted if they refused to cooperate with Thomas's questioning of their sympathies toward or past membership in the Communist Party. Actor John Garfield died of a heart attack brought on by anxiety the day before he was scheduled to testify before the HUAC. However, at the same time he was terrorizing Hollywood, Thomas was listing people on his office's payroll who never worked a minute on Capitol Hill in their lives. And by late 1949, J. Parnell Thomas was himself on his way to the same prison some of his Hollywood victims were sent to on his contempt of Congress decrees. By the 9th of February, 1950, the Red Scare was a national fear without a chief perpetrator. Joe McCarthy decided to grab that position for himself. During a Lincoln Day speech to the Republican Women's Club of Wheeling, West Virginia, McCarthy produced a sheet of paper that he claimed listed 205 known members of the Communist Party who had infiltrated the U.S. State Department in the Harry S. Truman administration. Almost overnight, this sensational claim brought a wave of new press interest in McCarthy, and he rode, or more accurately scammed, that interest to become the most powerful man in the Senate by 1952, when he won re-election to the Senate, after which McCarthy was made the chairman of the Senate Committee on Government Operations. That committee contained the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, which McCarthy immediately took as his own platform to hunt communists in Washington. He appointed as his chief counsel New York attorney Roy Cohn, who had successfully prosecuted Julius and Ethel Rosenberg for providing secret documents from the U.S. nuclear weapons program to the Soviet Union. The relentless McCarthy-Cohn investigation of the Voice of America, the government-operated external broadcasting service, drove one VOA engineer to commit suicide after testifying before the subcommittee. Then the subcommittee turned its attention to the Overseas Library Program of the International Information Agency. McCarthy and Cohn concocted a list of alleged communists and sympathizers whose books were to be removed from those libraries. Some of the libraries actually burned their copies of the books that McCarthy decreed banned. This brought an oblique criticism of McCarthy from then-President Dwight D. Eisenhower, who, without mentioning McCarthy by name, told Americans, "Don't join the book burners. Don't be afraid to go in your library and read every book." By the time McCarthy decided to look into the United States Army, newscaster Edward R. Murrow and producer Fred W. Friendly of the CBS television program See It Now decided to look into McCarthy. The two men had followed the demonic shenanigans of the senator since the Wheeling speech, and they decided to present their report about him on their telecast of March the 9th, 1954. Murrow and Friendly largely used McCarthy's own words on film to put the senator's character on display. The final portion of that broadcast sounded like this.
"He has interrogated a varied assortment of what he calls Fifth Amendment communists. Republican Senator Flanders of Vermont said of McCarthy today, 'He dons his war paint. He goes into his war dance. He emits his war whoops. He goes forth to battle and proudly returns with the scalp of a pink army dentist.'
Arrogant or witless man in a position of power appears before our committee and is found aiding the Communist Party. He will be exposed. The fact that he might be a general places him in no special class as far as I am concerned. Apparently the President and I now agree on the necessity of getting rid of communists. We apparently disagree only on how we should handle those who protect communists. When the shouting and the tumult dies, the American people and the President will realize that this unprecedented mudslinging against the committee by the extreme left-wing elements of press and radio was caused solely because another Fifth Amendment communist was finally dug out of the dark recesses and exposed to public view."
Now, Senator McCarthy claims that only the left-wing press criticized him on the Zwicker case. Of the 50 largest circulation newspapers in the country, these are the left-wing papers that criticized him. These are the ones that supported him. The ratio is about 3-1. Now, let us look at some of these left-wing papers that criticized the senator. The Chicago Tribune: "McCarthy will better serve his cause if he learns to distinguish the role of investigator from the role of avenging angel." The New York Times: "The unwarranted interference of a demagogue, a domestic Munich." The Times-Herald of Washington: "Senator McCarthy's behavior towards Zwicker not justified." The Herald-Tribune of New York: "McCarthyism involves assaults on basic Republican concepts." The Milwaukee Journal: The line must be drawn and defended, or McCarthy will become the government. The Evening Star of Washington. It was a bad day for everyone who resents and detests the bully boy tactics which Senator McCarthy so often employs. The New York World Telegram. Bamboozling, bludgeoning, distorting way. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Unscrupulous. McCarthy bullying. What a tragic irony it is that the president's political advisors keep him from doing what every decent instinct must be commanding him to do. Well, that's the ratio, about 3-1, so-called left-wing press. Another interesting thing was said about the Zwicker case, and it was said by Senator McCarthy.
Well, may I say that I was extremely shocked when I heard that Secretary Stevens told two Army officers that they had to take part in the cover-up of those who promoted and coddled communists. As I read his statement, I thought of that quotation, "On what meat doth this our Caesar feed?"
And upon what meat does Senator McCarthy feed? Two of the staples of his diet are the investigations, protected by immunity, and the half-truth. We herewith submit samples of both. First, the half-truth. This was an attack on Adlai Stevenson at the end of the 52 campaign. President Eisenhower, it must be said, had no prior knowledge of it.
I perform this unpleasant task because the American people are entitled to the coldly documented history of this man who says, "I want to be your president." But strangely, Adlai, well, but let's move on to another part of the jigsaw puzzle. Now, while you may think that there could be no connection between the debonair Democrat candidate and a dilapidated Massachusetts barn, I want to show you a picture of this barn and explain the connection. Here's the outside of a barn. Give me the picture showing the inside, if you will. Here's the outside of a barn up at Lee, Massachusetts. Looks like it couldn't house a farmer's cow or goat, the outside. Here's the inside. A beautifully paneled conference room with maps of the Soviet Union. Well, in what way does Stevenson tie up with this? My investigators went up and took pictures of this barn after we'd been tipped off as what was in it. Tipped off that there was in this barn all the missing documents from the Communist Front IPR. The IPR which had been named by the McCarran Committee. Named before the McCarran Committee as a cover shop for communist espionage. Now let's take a look at a photostat of a document taken from that Massachusetts barn. One of those documents that was never supposed to have seen the light of day. Rather interesting it is. This is the document that shows that Alger Hiss and Frank Coe recommended Adlai Stevenson to the Mont-Tremblant Conference, which was called for the purpose of establishing foreign policy, post-war foreign policy in Asia. Now, as you know, Alger Hiss is a convicted traitor. Frank Coe has been named under oath before congressional committees 7 times as a member of the Communist Party. Why do Hiss and Cole find that Adlai Stevenson is the man they want representing them at this conference? I don't know. Perhaps Adlai knows.
But Senator McCarthy didn't permit his audience to hear the entire paragraph. This is the official record of the McCarran hearings. Anyone can buy it for $2. Here's a quote. "Another possibility for the Mont-Tremblant conferences on Asia is someone from Knox's office or Stimson's office. Frank Knox was our wartime Secretary of the Navy. Henry Stimson, our Secretary of the Army, both distinguished Republicans." And it goes on, "Coe and Hiss mentioned Adlai Stevenson, one of Knox's special assistants, and Harvey Bundy, former Assistant Secretary of State under Hoover and now Assistant to Stimson, because of their jobs." We read from this documented record, not in defense of Mr. Stevenson, but in defense of truth. Specifically, Mr. Stevenson's identification with that red barn was no more, no less, than that of Knox, Stimson, or Bundy. It should be stated that Mr. Stevenson was once a member of the Institute of Pacific Relations, but so were such other loyal Americans as Senator Ferguson, John Foster Dulles, Paul Hoffman, Harry Luce, and Herbert Hoover. Their association carries with it no guilt, and that barn has nothing to do with any of them. Had he looked three lines earlier in Shakespeare's Caesar, he would have found this line, which is not altogether inappropriate. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves. No one familiar with the history of his country can deny that congressional committees are useful. It is necessary to investigate before legislating. But the line between investigating and persecuting is a very fine one, and the junior senator from Wisconsin has stepped over it repeatedly. His primary achievement has been in confusing the public mind as between the internal and the external threats of communism. We must not confuse dissent with disloyalty. We must remember always that accusation is not proof, and that conviction depends upon evidence and due process of law. We will not walk in fear one of another. We will not be driven by fear into an age of unreason if we dig deep in our history and our doctrine and remember that we are not descended from fearful men. Not from men who feared to write, to speak, to associate, and to defend causes that were for the moment unpopular. This is no time for men who oppose Senator McCarthy's methods to keep silent, or for those who approve. We can deny our heritage and our history, but we cannot escape responsibility for the result. There is no way for a citizen of a republic to abdicate his responsibilities. As a nation, we have come into our full inheritance at a tender age. We proclaim ourselves, as indeed we are, the defenders of freedom wherever it continues to exist in the world. But we cannot defend freedom abroad by deserting it at home. The actions of the junior senator from Wisconsin have caused alarm and dismay amongst our allies abroad and given considerable comfort to our enemies. And whose fault is that? Not really his. He didn't create this situation of fear. He merely exploited it, and rather successfully. Cassius was right. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves. Good night and good luck.
Perhaps significantly, very few of McCarthy's Wisconsin constituents ever got to see that program. The only Wisconsin station to broadcast the program was WCAN-TV, Channel 25 in Milwaukee, a UHF station in an age when UHF viewership was extremely small for a combination of reasons. WCAN's viewership was so small that the station eventually went out of business the following year. The CBS affiliate serving McCarthy's hometown of Appleton, WBAY-TV, Channel 2 out of Green Bay, refused to screen the Murrow broadcast and instead scheduled a filmed professional wrestling program from the competing Dumont Network. CBS board chairman William Paley insisted that Murrow and Friendly provide McCarthy equal time on a future See It Now telecast to set straight any part of the record that McCarthy felt Murrow had misrepresented. McCarthy initially tried to have columnist and publisher William F. Buckley Jr. to deliver the rebuttal, which CBS refused. Eventually, McCarthy accepted the half-hour himself, broadcast on April the 6th, but rather than identify anything in the March 9th broadcast that may have been an error, McCarthy delivered a strident personal attack on Murrow himself.
Good evening. Mr. Edward R. Murrow, Educational Director of the Columbia Broadcasting System, devoted his program to an attack on the work of the United States Senate Investigating Committee and on me personally as its chairman. Now, over the past 4 years, he has made repeated attacks upon me and those fighting communists. Now, of course, neither Joe McCarthy nor Edward R. Murrow is of any great importance as individuals. We are only important in our relation to the great struggle to preserve our American liberty. The Senate Investigating Committee has forced out of government and out of important defense plans communists engaged in the Soviet conspiracy. And you know, it's interesting to note that the viciousness of Murrow's attacks is in direct ratio to our success in digging out communists. Now, ordinarily I would not take time out from the important work at hand to answer Murrow, However, in this case, I feel justified in doing so because Murrow is the symbol, the leader, and the cleverest of the jackal pack, which is always found at the throat of anyone who dares to expose individual communists and traitors. I am compelled by the facts to say to you that Mr. Edward R. Murrow, as far back as 20 years ago, was engaged in propaganda for communist causes. For example, the Institute of International Education, of which he was the acting director, was chosen to act as a representative by a Soviet agency to do a job which would normally be done by the Russian secret police. Mr. Murrow sponsored a communist school in Moscow. In the selection of American students and teachers who were to attend, Mr. Murrow's organization acted for the Russian espionage and propaganda organization, known as Vox, V-O-K-S. And many of those selected were later exposed as communists. Murrow's organization selected such notorious communists as Isidore Begun, David Zabludowsky. Incidentally, Zabludowsky was forced out of the United Nations when my chief counsel presented his case to the grand jury and gave a picture of his communist activities. Now, Mr. Murrow, by his own admission, was a member of the IWW, that's the Industrial Workers of the World, a terrorist organization cited as subversive by an attorney general of the United States, who stated that it was an organization which seeks, and I quote, to alter the government of the United States by unconstitutional means. Now, other government committees have had before them actors, screenwriters, motion picture producers, and others who admitted communist affiliations, but pleaded youth or ignorance. Now, Mr. Murrow can hardly make the same plea. On March 9 of this year, Mr. Murrow, a trained reporter who had traveled all over the world, who was the educational director of CBS, followed implicitly the communist line as laid down in the last 6 months, laid down not only by the communist Daily Worker, but by the communist magazine Political Affairs and by the National Conference of the Communist Party of the United States of America. Now the question, why is it important to you, the people of America, to know why the educational director and the vice president of CBS so closely follows the Communist Party line? To answer that question, we must turn back the pages of history. A little over 100 years ago, a little group of men in Europe conspired to deliver the world to a new system, to communism. Under their system, the individual was nothing, the family was nothing, God did not even exist. Their theory was that an all-powerful state should have the power of life or death over its citizens without even a trial, that everything and everybody belonged to the rulers of the states. They openly wrote, nothing secret about it, that in their efforts to gain power, they would be justified in doing anything. They would be justified in following the trail of deceit, lies, terror, murder, treason, blackmail. All these things were elevated to virtues in the communist rule book. If a convert to communism could be persuaded that he was a citizen of the world, it of course would be much easier to make him a traitor to his own country. Now for 70 years, the communists made little progress. Let me show you a map of the world as it stood in the middle of the First World War in 1917 before the Russian Revolution. You will see there is not a single foot of ground on the face of the globe under the domination or control of the communists. And bear in mind that this was only 36 years ago. In 1917, we were engaged in a great world war in defense of our way of life and in defense of American liberty. The Kaiser was obliged to divide his armies and fight on both the Eastern and the Western Front. In the midst of the war, the Russian people overthrew their czarist master, and they set up a democratic form of government under the leadership of Alexander Kerensky. Now, Kerensky's government instantly pledged all-out support to the Allies. At this instant, the Imperial German government secretly financed the return to Russia of 7 communist exiles led by Nikolai Lenin, exiles who had been forced to flee the country. A rather important event in the history of the world. Now, once in Russia, by the same methods which the communists are employing in the United States today, they undermine the army, they undermine the navy, the civilian heads of the government. And in 100 days, those 7 communists were literally the masters of Russia. Now, with all of the wealth of the nation at their command, they proceeded to finance communist parties in every country of the world. They sent to those countries trained propagandists and spies. In every country, they, of course, had to find glib, clever men like Edward R. Murrow, who would sponsor invitations to students and teachers to attend indoctrination schools in Moscow, exactly as Murrow has done. They trained communists in every country in the world. Their sole purpose was to infiltrate the government, and once communists were in government, they in turn brought others in. Now let us look at the map of the world as it was 20 years ago. At that time, there was one country with 180 million people in communist chains. Now let us look at a map of the world as of tonight, this 6th day of April 1954. Over 1/3 of the Earth's area under communist control, and 800 million people in communist chains. In addition to the 800 million in communist chains in Europe and Asia, finally, the communists have gained a foothold and a potential military base here in our half of the world, in Guatemala, with the communists seeping down into the Honduras. My good friends, how much of this was achieved by military force, and how much was achieved by traitors and communist lying propagandists in our own government and in other free governments? Let's start in Europe, if we may. They took by military force a little piece of Finland. In the same way, they took 3 small Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. They took half of Poland the same way. They acquired the rest of Poland through Polish traitors. And communists in our own government, who gave American dollars and American support to the communists in Poland. They took over Romania, Bulgaria, and Hungary without firing a single shot. They did this by the infiltration of communists in a key spots in the governments. The communists took over Czechoslovakia without firing a shot. This they did by the infiltration of communists into the Czechoslovakian government also. And listen to what a high official in the anti-communist government of Czechoslovakia had to say about the communist enslavement of Czechoslovakia. Here's what he said. He said, in my country, the pattern was identical to what it is in the United States. If anyone, before the communists took over, dared to attack those communists who were preparing and shaping the policy of my government, shaping the policy to betray my people, he was promptly attacked and destroyed by a combination of communists, fellow travelers, and those unthinking people who thought they were serving the cause of liberalism and progress, but who were actually serving the cause of the most reactionary credo of all times, communism. Still quoting, because of those people, night has fallen upon my nation and slavery upon my people. Now shifting to another area of the world, the East, how about this vast land area? And the teeming masses of China. Let's just take a look at that map, if you please. Keep in mind that a few short years ago, China was a free nation friendly to the United States. Now, let's take a look at that map. Were those 400 million Chinese captured by force of arms? Certainly not. They were delivered to communist slave masters by the jackal pack of communist lying propagandists, including the friends of Mr. Edward R. Murrow, who day after day shouted to the world that the Chinese communists were agrarian reformers and that our ally, the Republic of China, represented everything that was evil and wicked. Now, my good friends, if there were no communists in our government, would we have consented to and connived to turn over all of our Chinese friends to the Russians? Now, my good friends, if there had been no communists in our government, would we have rewarded them with all of Manchuria, half of the Kuril Islands, and one half of Korea? Now, how many Americans have died and will die because of this sellout to communist Russia? God only knows. If there were no communists in our government, why did we delay for 18 months, delay our research on the hydrogen bomb, even though our intelligence agencies were reporting day after day that the Russians were feverishly pushing their development of the H-bomb? And may I say to America tonight that our nation may well die because of that 18 months deliberate delay. And I ask you, who caused it? Was it loyal Americans or was it traitors in our government? It is often said by the left wing that it is sufficient to fight communism in Europe and Asia, but that communism is not a domestic American issue. But the record, my good friends, is that the damage has been done by cleverly calculated subversion at home and not from abroad. It is this problem of subversion that our committee faces. Now let us very quickly glance at some of the work of our committee. Some of the work is done in slightly over a year's time. For example, 238 witnesses were examined in public session, 367 witnesses examined in executive session, 84 witnesses refused to testify as to communist activities on the ground that if they told the truth, they might go to jail, 24 witnesses with communist backgrounds have been discharged from jobs which they were handling secret, top secret, confidential material. Individuals were exposed before our committee. Of course, you can't measure the success of a committee by a box score based on the number of communist heads that have rolled from secret jobs. It is completely impossible to even estimate the effect on our government of the day-to-day plotting exposure of communists. And that is, of course, why the Murrows bleed. For example, the exposure of only one Fifth Amendment communist in the government printing office, an office having access to secret material from almost every government agency, resulted in an undisclosed number of suspensions. It resulted in the removal of the loyalty board and the revamping of all the loyalty rules, so that we do have apparently a good tight loyalty set up in the printing office this time. Also, a disclosure of communists in the military. And the radar laboratories resulted in the abolition of the Pentagon board, which had cleared and ordered reinstated communists who had for years been handling government secrets. Also, as a result of those hearings, Army orders have been issued to prevent the recurrence of the major press scandal, which was exposed by the committee. Now, to attempt to evaluate the effect of the work of an investigating committee would be about as impossible as to attempt to evaluate the effect of well-trained watchdogs upon the activities of potential burglars.
The remainder of McCarthy's half hour was exactly like this, with McCarthy delivering what some saw as crackpot history at best, and out libel of Murrow and Friendly at worst. On the See It Now broadcast of April 13th, Murrow delivered this response to the McCarthy attack.
Last week, Senator McCarthy appeared on this program to correct any errors he might have thought we made in our report of March 9th. Since he made no reference to any statements of fact that we made, we must conclude that he found no errors of fact. He proved again that anyone who exposes him, anyone who does not share his hysterical disregard for decency and human dignity and the rights guaranteed by the Constitution, must be either a communist or a fellow traveler. I fully expected this treatment. The senator added this reporter's name to a long list of individuals and institutions he has accused of serving the communist cause. His proposition is very simple. Anyone who criticizes or opposes McCarthy's methods must be a communist. And if that be true, there are an awful lot of communists in this country. For the record, let's consider briefly some of the senator's charges. He claimed, but offered no proof, that I had been a member of the Industrial Workers of the World. That is false. I was never a member of the IWW, never applied for membership. Men that I worked with in the Pacific Northwest in Western Washington and logging camps will attest that I never had any affiliation or affinity with that organization. The senator charged that Professor Harold Lasky, a British scholar and politician, dedicated a book to me. That's true. He is dead. He was a socialist. I am not. He was one of those civilized individuals who did not insist upon agreement with his political principles as a precondition for conversation or friendship. I did not agree with his political ideas. Lasky, as he makes clear in the introduction, dedicated the book to me not because of political agreement, but because he held my wartime broadcast from London in high regard. And the dedication so reads. Senator McCarthy's principal attack on me was an attack on the Institute of International Education, of which I was assistant director and am now a trustee. Together with such people as John Foster Dulles, Milton Eisenhower, Ralph J. Bunce, Virginia Gildersleeve, Philip Reed, to name just a few. That institute sponsored, acted as the registering agent, for summer schools in foreign countries, including England, France, and Germany, and one in the Soviet Union in 1934. It has arranged in all some 30,000 exchanges of students and professors between the United States and over 50 foreign countries. The man primarily responsible for starting this institute was Nicholas Murray Butler in 1919. Its work has been praised as recently as 1948 by President Eisenhower. It has been denounced by the Soviet press and radio as a center of international propaganda for American reaction, and I have been labeled by them as a reactionary radio commentator. The senator alleged that we were doing the work of the Russian secret police, training spies. We were, in fact, conducting normal cultural and educational relations with foreign nations. The Moscow summer session was canceled in 1935 by the Russian authorities. I believe 20 years ago, and I believe today, that mature Americans can engage in conversation and controversy, the clash of ideas with communists anywhere in the world without becoming contaminated or converted. I believe that our faith, our conviction, our determination are stronger than theirs, and that we can compete, and successfully, not only in the area of bombs, but in the area of ideas. Senator McCarthy couldn't even get my present relationship with CBS straight. He repeatedly referred to me as the educational director, a position I have not held for 17 years. The senator waved a copy of the Daily Worker, saying an article in it has praised me. Here is an example of what Senator McCarthy calls praise by William Z. Foster in the March 17 issue of the Daily Worker. Quote, "During the past 10 days, Senator McCarthy has received a number of resounding belts in the jaw. These came from Adlai Stevenson, E.R. Murrow, Senator Flanders, the Army leadership, broadcasting companies. Even Eisenhower himself had to give McCarthy a slap on the wrist." That was the sole reference to me in Mr. Foster's article. Another charge by Senator McCarthy was that Owen Lattimore mentioned me in a book. What Lattimore said in substance was that he had never met me, but that I had done a fair job of reporting his testimony. In short, that I had not presumed his guilt. Everything I said on that case is a matter of record and can be examined by anyone who is interested. I hope to continue to present evidence developed before congressional committees as impartially as I am able. And that specifically includes the hearings before which Senator McCarthy is shortly scheduled to appear. I have worked for CBS for more than 19 years. The company has subscribed fully to my integrity and responsibility as a broadcaster and as a loyal American. I require no lectures from the junior senator from Wisconsin as to the dangers or terrors of communism. Having watched the aggressive forces at work in Western Europe, having had friends in Eastern Europe butchered and driven into exile, having broadcast from London in 1943 that the Russians were responsible for the Katyn massacre, having told the story of the Russian refusal to allow Allied aircraft to land on Russian fields after dropping supplies to those who rose in Warsaw and then were betrayed by the Russians, and having been denounced by the Russian radio for these reports, I cannot feel that I require instruction from the senator on the evils of communism. Having searched my conscience and my files, I cannot contend that I have always been right or wise, but I have attempted to pursue the truth with some diligence and to report it, even though, as in this case, I had been warned in advance that I would be subjected to the attentions of Senator McCarthy. We shall hope to deal with matters of more vital interest to the country next week. Good night and good luck.
A couple of days later, on Murrow's CBS radio program, he reported on developments in McCarthy's squabble with the Army and expanded on his response to McCarthy's April 6th telecast.
Once again tonight, Senator McCarthy and Army Secretary Stevens are in violent verbal disagreement. An Army report says that Senator McCarthy and his chief counsel, Roy Cohn, applied pressure and threats to the Army to try to get special treatment for a former committee aide, David Shine, who was drafted into the Army. The Army report says the 27-year-old the Army. Cohn denies this, and he and McCarthy say the Army has been using this report in an attempt to blackmail the McCarthy Committee to give up its search for communists in the Army. McCarthy today released an unsigned memorandum saying that Army Secretary Stevens once suggested that the committee aim its search for communists at the Navy, the Air Force, and the Defense Department. The unsigned McCarthy memorandum says Stevens offered to furnish leads and plenty of dirt for such an investigation. Secretary Stevens promptly called this utterly untrue. And the Army's legal counsel, John G. Adams, who is alleged to have had conversations with McCarthy on such things, calls the McCarthy memorandum fantastic and false. One McCarthy committee member, Republican Potter of Michigan, called for a quick hearing to determine whether what he called these shocking charges against Cohn are true. Another Republican committee member, Dirksen of Illinois, said McCarthy violated an agreement with other Republicans not to release his memorandum, at least until they had discussed the Army's report on McCarthy and Cohn. Dirksen says the present controversy has gone far enough. The three Democrats on the committee want an early hearing on the Army's report. So does Republican Senator Munt, another member. Senator McCarthy left Washington today to make some speeches in Wisconsin. I am obliged to assume that most people have on their minds matters of more considerable substance than Senator McCarthy's opinion of this reporter, or my opinion of him. However, it might serve some purpose to set at least some part of the record straight. Let us begin with the subject of the Civil Liberties Union. Here is Senator McCarthy's statement on that subject, recorded while he was interrogating Reed Harris.
Did the Civil Liberties Union provide you with an attorney at that time?
I had many offers of attorneys, and one of those was from the American Civil Liberties Union, yes.
The question is, did the Civil Liberties Union supply you with an attorney?
They did supply an attorney.
The answer is yes.
The answer is yes.
You know, the Civil Liberties Union has been listed as a front for and doing the work of the Communist Party.
Mr. Chairman, this was 1932.
Yeah, I know this by 1932. Do you know that the stunts have been listed? as a front foreman doing the work of the Communist Party?
I do not know that they have been listed so, sir.
You don't know they have been listed?
I have heard that mention, and it's a read that mention.
Now here is this reporter's comment made on a recent television program. The Reed-Harris hearing demonstrates one of the senator's techniques. Twice, he said the American Civil Liberties Union was listed as a subversive front. The Attorney General's list does not and has never listed the ACLU as subversive, nor does the FBI or any other federal government agency. And the American Civil Liberties Union holds in its files letters of commendation from President Truman, President Eisenhower, and General MacArthur. Here again is what Senator McCarthy said last night when asked by Fulton Lewis, Jr. to comment on my remarks.
Well, may I say that there are some individuals in the ACLU who are good Americans, but Murrow again was not telling the truth when he said it had not been listed. I have, as you see here, Fulton, the fourth report of the Un-American Activities Committee in California. I quote from page 107, and this is a quotation in regard to the organization which Murrow said had not been listed. Quote, the American Civil Liberties Union may be definitely classed as a communist front or transmission belt organization. At least 90% of its efforts are expended on behalf of communists who come into conflict with the law. So that, again, Mr. Murrow is not telling the truth.
I specifically stated the Attorney General's list, the FBI, and any other government agency. Someone lied. There's no doubt about that. Now let us turn to another subject. Mr. Lewis last night asked the senator to comment on a television program of which I am the editor. Here is Senator McCarthy's reply. I have no hesitation in giving it such circulation as this broadcast may enjoy.
Well, I may say, Fulton, that I have a little difficulty answering the specific attacks that he made because I never listened to the extreme left-wing, bleeding-heart elements of radio or television.
The senator may have me there. I may be a bleeding heart, being not quite sure of what it means. As for being extreme left-wing, that is political shorthand. But if the senator means that I am somewhat to the left of his position and of Louis XIV, he is correct. Now, here are the facts about that Moscow summer school. The date was 1935. I was the assistant director of the Institute of International Education. This organization dealt primarily with the exchange of students and professors between this and foreign countries. It had established offices in London, Paris, Berlin, Geneva, and elsewhere. It was largely financed at that time by the Carnegie Corporation and the Rockefeller Foundation. Among its board of trustees were such as John Foster Dulles, John Bassett Moore, Thomas W. Lamont, Virginia Gildersleeve, and others equally distinguished. This board of trustees created an advisory committee in connection with the summer school in Moscow for graduate students, teachers, and professors. Here is the list of advisors. W. W. Charters, Director, Bureau of Educational Research, Ohio State University. Harry Woodburn Chase, Chancellor of New York University. George S. Counts, Professor of Education, Teachers College, Columbia University. John Dewey, Professor Emeritus of Philosophy, Columbia University. Stephen Duggan, Director, Institute of International Education. Hallie F. Flanagan, Professor of English, Vassar College. Frank P. Graham, President, University of North Carolina. Robert M. Hutchins, President, University of Chicago. Charles H. Judd, Dean, School of Education, University of Chicago. I. L. Kendall, Professor of Education, Teachers College, Columbia University. Robert L. Kelly, Secretary, Association of American Colleges. John A. Kingsbury, Secretary, Millbank Memorial Fund. Susan M. Kingsbury, Professor of Social Economy and Social Research, Bryn Mawr College. Paul Clapper, Dean, School of Education, College of the City of New York. Charles R. Mann, Director, American Council on Education. Edward R. Murrow, Assistant Director, Institute of International Education. William Allen Nielsen, President, Smith College. Howard W. Odom, Professor of Sociology, University of North Carolina. William F. Russell, Dean, Teachers College, Columbia University. H. W. Tyler, General Secretary, American Association of University Professors. Ernest H. Wilkins, President, Oberlin College. John W. Withers, Dean, School of Education, New York University. Thomas Woody, Professor of History of Education, University of Pennsylvania. Harvey W. Zorbaugh,
Director, Clinic for the Social Adjustment of Gifted Children, New York University. Some of the persons on that list are now dead, but presumably not yet immune from the senator's attentions. It was and is a rather distinguished list, and I plead neither ignorance nor youth as the reason for my name being on it. The Russian authorities abruptly and without satisfactory explanation canceled the proposed summer school before it began, and most of the prospective members spent the summer traveling in the Soviet Union. I did not accompany the group to the Soviet Union. No effort was made to revive the venture, and the advisory council was therefore dissolved. The Institute of International Education continued to arrange student and professorial exchanges and to make arrangements for American students to attend the summer sessions in various foreign countries, but not in the Soviet Union. I believed 18 years ago, and I believe today, that mature American graduate students and professors can engage in conversation and controversy, the clash of ideas, with communists anywhere under peacetime conditions without becoming contaminated or converted. To deny this would be to admit that in the realm of ideas, faith and conviction, the communist cause, dogma and doctrine is stronger than our own. This reporter declines to admit that, but remains uncertain as to Senator McCarthy's position on this matter. This seems to be the open season for quoting Lincoln. Last night, Senator McCarthy quoted from a Lincoln speech of 1838. I'd like to read you these words from that same speech. I hope I am over-wary, but if I am not, there is even now something of ill omen amongst us. I mean the increasing disregard for law which pervades the country, the growing disposition to substitute the wild and furious passions in lieu of the sober judgment of courts, and the worse than savage mobs for the executive ministers of justice. Good night and good luck.
Now, while all this was going on, one of the Hollywood types that got caught up in the McCarthyist buzzsaw was a radio comedy writer named Reuben Shipp. A Canadian by birth, Shipp had moved to Hollywood by the 1940s and was one of the chief writers for the extremely popular radio situation comedy The Life of Riley, starring William Bendix, from 1944 to 1951. Among Shipp's biggest contributions to the series was the creation of the character Digby, or Digger, O'Dell, the friendly undertaker of Riley's California neighborhood. The exchanges between Riley and Digger, utilizing Shipp's flair for writing macabre humor, were usually a highlight of each episode. An example is this excerpt from The Life of Riley broadcast on December 13, 1947, featuring Bendix as Riley and John Brown as Digger. Fittingly for this program, the general topic of the script that week was Riley's daughter Babs being blackballed from joining a sorority at her college.
Oh, what a mess. What good am I? I'm no good to Babs, I'm no good to Junior, I'm no good to anybody. I'm just so much dead weight.
That's good enough for me.
Who's that?
It is I, Digby O'Dell, the friendly undertaker.
Oh, how are you, Digger?
Ah, there's good news tonight. I've just bought a brand new business vehicle, a Studebaker.
Oh, yeah, I like them. Lots of glass. The people in the back can see where they're going.
Can they? But it's just the kind of car I need in my business. A tight clutch, a fast pickup. Someday I'll give you a ride in it. You won't even know you're moving.
I got big trouble, Digger, about my daughter.
Ah, yes. Teenage children can be a problem. Yesterday, a gang of hoodlums pilfered a sign from a department store and hung it on the door of my business establishment. Oh, I was incensed.
Well, why? What did the sign say?
Christmas is coming. Try our convenient layaway plan.
Oh, Yeah, but it's more serious with Bed. She was supposed to join a sorority.
And Helene Bidwell blackballed her.
Well, yeah, how did you know?
In my business, I have to know what's what and who's where.
Poor Babs, she's all broken up.
Oh, the poor child. I remember how eager I was to join the leading fraternity at dear old Undertaker's prep.
Did they try to keep you out?
Yes, there was considerable mudslinging. But finally they accepted me. Here's my flat pin with our motto in Latin. Accidentum quor non in presentia.
Well, what does that mean?
Eventually, why not now?
Digger, the sorority is meeting tonight, but I'm afraid it's too late to do anything for Bed.
But at least you can have some satisfaction. Go to this meeting. Tell those little pipsqueaks off.
You're right, Digger. It's at Bidwell's house. I'll tell him off, too. Nobody's going to throw dirt in my face.
If anybody tries that, you come to me. Well, cheerio. I'd better be shoveling off.
Before writing The Life of Riley, Reuben Shipp had been a member of the Communist Party and later became a union activist involved in a dispute between two unions trying to gain a dominant position in Hollywood television production during the early days of that medium. Shipp was subpoenaed to testify to the HUAC, but refused to cooperate at the time and was labeled a political subversive. However, to the HUAC's dismay, he was still a Canadian citizen. So instead of imprisoning him in the United States, the Immigration and Naturalization Service arrested Shipp in July 1953 in Hollywood, and after a prolonged legal hassle, deported him back to Canada at Windsor, Ontario. Once back in Canada, Shipp wrote a satire of the HUAC and Joseph McCarthy's congressional shenanigans titled The Investigator, which was broadcast by the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation's nationwide radio network, audible throughout the northern tier of the United States, on May the 30th of 1954, at midpoint in the span of the Senate Army McCarthy hearings. In a moment, we will be hearing that production as it was presented by the CBC, with John Drainey starring as the title character, obviously McCarthy without actually applying his name to the play, and Canadian actors Barry Morse and James Doohan in the supporting cast. Perhaps ironically, a decade later, the two actors would gain their biggest fame in two popular Hollywood-produced television series. Morse as Lieutenant Philip Gerard, the policeman who tirelessly followed David Janssen as Dr. Richard Kimball through four seasons on The Fugitive, and Doohan as Lieutenant Commander Montgomery Scott, or Scotty, the second officer and chief engineer of the USS Enterprise for three television seasons and several theatrical films in the series Star Trek. First, however, a break for this station to identify itself and take care of some business. This is McCarthy, the American Ism, a special presentation of Echoes of a Century. I'm King David McKenzie, and I'll be back after Reuben Shipp's The Investigator.